But you could, it was extremely dangerous to walk in the streets. But Adam Shapiro agreed to try to walk us to a food relief station, a medical relief station too, on the other side of the city under a white flag. And so we walked out into the streets where you see the same kind of thing, cars destroyed, and he's waving a white flag. We went about electricity poles down, you know, no water service. We got about two blocks, and then up ahead, in back of that little white sawhorse, that's an armored personnel carrier with sandbags on the top and machine gun. And there are Israeli snipers on either side, and one of them fired a warning shot in our direction. Adam screamed at them, you know, can't you see you're carrying a white flag? And they fired again a little closer. So Adam decided this was not a good street to go on. Also, there was an explosion just to the right somewhere. And he told us, so I think with a lot of sympathy, he said, well, when there's an explosion, the soldiers have to come out of their armored personnel carriers and go and investigate inside a building to the degree of the damage. And he said they feel particularly vulnerable when they're outside of the vehicles. And that's when they're more likely to shoot you. So, you know, I thought that was rather sympathetic, you know, to see them as fearful individuals, you know, as opposed to some stereotype. So anyway, we went a different route, avoided the soldiers. All while we're walking, we can hear occasional gunfire and shooting in different directions. The city of Ramallah, which I saw, was not as badly damaged as Bethlehem. There were occasional buildings all burned out like this one here. It was also apparent here, as well as in Bethlehem, that the attacks were against the civilian infrastructure of these cities. Banks were destroyed. All of the hard drives in every bank were destroyed. Not seized for intelligence, but destroyed. The Ministry of Education was very, very badly vandalized. Not only were all the educational records destroyed, shattered, but the Department of Motor Vehicles, all of their records were shattered, were destroyed. The Land Registry Record Office, all of their records were destroyed. Essentially, all of the information infrastructure of a Palestinian state was shredded. And in many instances, like in the Ministry of Education, not only was the building destroyed, but children's art was pulled from the wall, and the soldiers defecated on the art. They defecated in the Xerox machine on the desks. They urinated on the Palestinian chairs and file cabinets and so on. So it was really a very, very angry and ferocious attack on things that had really nothing to do with interdicting terrorist organizations. Finally, we reached this relief office, which was in a 4 or 5-story apartment building. It was in one of the floors of this apartment building. When we got to the third or fourth floor where the offices were, we saw that they had been attacked with machine guns. This is a dead Xerox machine. They seized the file cabinets from... This is a medical relief office. I'm not sure why they attacked that. The apartment, which was next door, tank shells went through the apartment. There were, you know, obviously civilian apartments, you know, little backpacks, things destroyed. In the basement of that building was a supply of relief, a big kind of warehouse of relief supplies, but they had no means to distribute it around the city. So we packed it in boxes, a little rice, a little sugar, a little wheat, a little flour, so on and so on. And we took them in ambulances around the city. This is a woman from Sweden on the right here. They gave us these nice little nifty jackets. And then we proceeded to walk through the city again to see most of it. And we were walking along one road, and all of a sudden we turned the corner, and there was a tank right next to us. We didn't even see the stupid thing. And two soldiers burst out. They looked like they're about 17. And they were very angry and pointing their guns. Who are you? What are you doing? Adam is really pretty calm in the situation, and he explained. He was from the relief office. And they said, who are those people, you know, with all the others behind? And he said, them, he says, they're war tourists. He said there's even a website, war tourist, www.com. He says, look it up. And then one of the soldiers said, well, what's in your bag? And I had a bag full of candy for giving to Palestinian kids, which, by the way, is a very bad idea unless you're in a very small group, because that can cause, you know, a real riot starting to give out candy. But anyway, he looked in my bag, saw the candy, and figured we were harmless, and so the soldier said we could go. And then they turned their radio on, and they started, or their tape player, and they started listening to Bob Marley's I Shot the Sheriff. So it's like such a weird kind of thing. And, you know, these young, you know, people like any other young person in this situation, you're riding around in a tank in people's cities. But when we reached back to the hospital, three bodies had been brought in during our 2-hour absence. 3-hour absence. And bringing a body to the hospital is very difficult because of the curfew. And so at this point, no one knew how many people had actually been killed in the attack on Ramallah. But three bodies were brought in. The first was a 24-year-old man. And people didn't know the circumstance of his death, but he had been shot through the buttocks all the way up his body to his neck. And a single bullet had killed him. The second person, people in Ramallah were heartbroken about this. He's a 22-year-old who was deaf and mentally retarded. And he had, in previous instances, repeatedly ignored curfews, walking through the streets singing and talking to soldiers. And he ignored this curfew as well. He was last seen with 11 Israeli soldiers chasing him, and he had three bullet wounds. It was really a tragic one. But the worst one was this woman, a 28-year-old mother of three, who, according to her husband, was inside her home looking out the window of the living room when she was shot by an Israeli sniper, a single bullet through the heart. Her three small children were in the room with her when she died. And her husband, in grief, carried her body through the streets of the city. He could have been shot at any time, to the hospital. Beyond belief, hysterical. Why did they kill her? What has she done? You know, how will I care for my children? And so on. And there was another body that had been brought in that day, but it was not someone who had been killed that day. It was somebody's body was at least a week into decomposition that had been found. See, some of the people had been shot and nobody could deliver bodies, so they would be in homes or streets or anywhere. But they had nine other bodies in the morgue at the time, so they were almost at capacity and have to dig another mass grave. That afternoon, we wanted to leave Ramallah through ambulances again, but the Israelis set up a sniper post right across from the hospital, shooting in both directions, until one of the Japanese with us was able to convince the Israeli commander that this was a bad thing to let us photograph. So then they left, and we were able to actually get out of Ramallah. When we got back to Jerusalem, two members of our group, Kathy Kelly from Chicago and Jeff Gunsel, went north to try to make it into Jenin, which was under very severe curfew and closure. Whereas Grace Ritter and Audrey Stewart from the Ithaca Catholic Worker and I wanted to join Israeli activists who were going to do a demonstration like the one at Ramallah inside Israel heading towards Jenin. So we went to West Jerusalem where there was a busload of Israeli activists. We made the sign, Americans Demand to See Jenin. And we went with the Israeli activists in a bus up to Megiddo, which is the a place in the northern Israel, not far from Haifa. And it's the last Israeli town before the road into the West Bank that goes to Jenin. And it's actually the site of the terrorist attack yesterday that that killed 16 Israelis, is Megiddo. And so we joined the Israelis to go there. One of the Israeli organizers is Nev Gordon. And Nev Gordon is an Israeli Jew, a journalist who writes for National Catholic Reporter. And he was familiar with my wife's writing because she writes for them quite a bit. And when he heard who I was, he said, "Oh, I'm really glad you're here." And he says, "But I wish your wife had come because I've seen your writing and she's a better writer." So, you know, you could do a lot of things, but you could still get dissed, even overseas. When we got to Megiddo, there were piles of water and food and other clean clothing the Israelis had brought. And this time, they didn't fill three trucks. They filled 31 trucks with supplies to bring to people in Jenin, because stories were coming out 16 days with no water, no electricity, severe curfew, and lots of destruction. The Israeli activist said, this is somebody from Gush Shalom, a wonderful peace group. And by the way, afterwards, I have a list of Israeli and Palestinian groups up here with all their websites and phone numbers, and please take it. And this is the banner that led the march of 3,000. A wonderful, wonderful thing. There were Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs, and the Israeli Jews made the point, if you're an international or an Israeli Jew, stand next to an Israeli Arab, because if there's tear gas or beatings, the dark-skinned person will be targeted. And so we marched the 5 miles or so, 4 miles maybe, to the checkpoint to the West Bank at Salem. And there were about 30 tanks there and about 500 soldiers. We vigiled there for a while, and then the Israeli soldiers very quickly agreed to allow the delivery of the relief supplies. I think they realized that the demonstration at Ramallah was a public relations disaster, so they allowed the delivery. As it turns out, four of those trucks reached Jenin City, not the refugee camp, which is adjacent, and the rest of them, the supplies were dumped on the side of the road in a ditch. So unfortunately, the agreement by the soldiers wasn't completely honest, although some of the supplies did get near. While we were at this demonstration, Audrey Grace and I met two international activists, one from Canada and the other from, I think, from South America, I forget now, who we said we wanted to go into the West Bank to join Kathy Kelly and Jeff Gunsel in an attempt to reach Jenin. And so they drove us in a U.S. Embassy car, by the way, actually. They drove us in a U.S. Embassy car, I don't remember why they had it, to the Arab town of Umm Al-Fan in Israel, and they pointed us a way to go over into the West Bank, over in a mountain, to avoid a checkpoint over a path. So here we are going over this path with some other activists. And down below in the West Bank, you can see the first white village is the village of Taibeh. And beyond it is another Romani. And way in the distance is Jenin, about 17 miles. And when we reached Taibeh, which is where Kathy and Jeff were, we went immediately to an elementary school, which had been made into a refugee center for 200 male refugees from Jenin. And we came in just as a young 18-year-old was being brought in, and he had wounds being dressed. And he gave us an interview. He told us that this is what happened to him in Jenin. On April 2nd at 2 a.m., Israeli helicopters flew over the camp and fired missiles into the center of the camp. The house that he was in was blown up, and he was thrown into the street, and he got a wound in his shoulder, a shrapnel wound. Five Palestinians picked him up and carried him into another house. An Israeli tank came and fired on that house, killing the five people that had rescued him. He pulled himself out of that house, now with a leg wound, to a third house, and then an Israeli bulldozer came and bulldozed that house. He managed to pull himself through the window into another house as the bulldozer advanced on this fourth house, and now he pulled himself into a fifth house where he found about five or six Palestinian girls hiding under a stairway, and he hid with them until an Israeli soldier came and shot him in the leg and took him prisoner. He was blindfolded and handcuffed for 2 days, not given water or food or shelter. It rained, and it was a cold rain at night, held outside. At the end of 2 days, he was interrogated for two more days, beaten, repeatedly tried to force to make a statement that he was a terrorist. He kept saying he was an administration student at the university. Finally, he was driven to outside Romani at midnight and dropped off in his underwear. All the while, he has three wounds, two shrapnel and one bullet wound, all untreated. And so he walked from there in his underwear to Taibeh, where he was receiving his first aid. We interviewed other refugees who said that they had been taken blindfolded, tied to the front of tanks as human shields by the Israelis. Others, an elderly man, said that he was blindfolded and his shoulder was used as a gun rack for an Israeli machine gun. And he heard a child crying next to him and realized it was his 12-year-old son, whose shoulder was also being used as a gun rack. These two individuals showed us their shoulders, which were swollen and badly burned, which would be consistent with their story. We also interviewed refugees who claimed, who said they were receiving cell phone calls. Everybody there, by the way, has a cell phone. Receiving cell phone calls from surviving family members who were buried under debris in Jenin and appealing for rescue. In one instance, there was a family of 15, another an extended family of 25 trapped under the debris. And after 3 days, the signals went dead. It's unclear if the batteries went dead or whether or not the people had actually died. Refugees were making many appeals to international relief agencies, Red Cross, Red Crescent, so on, for the Israelis to allow relief agencies to go in to search for survivors, and those were being rebuffed. When we reached Taibeh, we decided as a group of five that we wanted to get to Jenin. It was essential for us to see with our own eyes what was happening. We asked the international activists in Taibeh, could we walk on the main road to Jenin? And they said, no, we would be shot, arrested, or deported. And we said, what about going over the mountains through mountain passes? And now, they said, you'll be shot and killed. And there were helicopter gunships actually flying overhead, firing into those mountains while they were saying this. So we could see that that was a possibility. And so we got a very negative sort of impression from these activists. But we're Americans, and Americans can be very stubborn. And so the next day we said, we're going to try it. But we developed a modified plan. And our plan was we got a ride to Romani, and we were going to walk to the solemn checkpoint. And we had kind of an American model. We were going to walk up to that checkpoint. When the soldiers asked what we were doing, we were going to say, we're Americans trying to see what's happening in Jenin. We have to see with our own eyes what our tax dollars are being used for. When the soldiers inevitably refused to let us pass, we would sit down, interlock our arms, sing badly, civil rights songs and so on, and probably be arrested and maybe work our way into the media. But as it turns out, we started approaching this checkpoint and no soldiers reacted. We got closer and closer, and hundreds of them standing around, nobody did anything. We walked right by the guard booth, right through all these soldiers, right by all these tanks to the other side, and we said, what the heck is this? What's going on here? And then it occurred to us that we had screwed up the geography. We were inside the territories, walking out. And the soldiers had presumed, since we were walking out, we'd gotten permission from somebody else elsewhere. We said, well, what are we going to do now? And he said, well, let's walk right back in. So we walked back in, and again, people presumed we must know what we're doing. And so we walked right by them. And we started down the road towards Jenin, feeling a little elation. And a military vehicle stopped. There were lots of tanks and jeeps and other vehicles going towards Jenin. One military vehicle stopped, and the officer asked us what we were doing, and we answered rather obscurely. We said, we've already passed through the checkpoint. And he said, okay, and left, you know, presuming we had permission. We didn't actually say that, you know. And I went to a Jesuit school, by the way. That's called Jesuitical thinking. But anyway, we went a little farther, and a little bit more savvy Israeli stopped, military police officer with two assistants, and he figured out what we really were doing, and he said, you can't go forward. It's a closed military area. It's not safe for you. We said, we're willing to take the risk. He said, it doesn't matter. You can't go anyway. I'm not authorized. And we said, well, we're not going to go back. He ordered us back, and he said, if you don't go back, I'll have to call my superior officer, and he's a really mean guy. I said, look, both my brother-in-laws were in Vietnam, and everybody's superior officer is a mean guy. And he finally called a major. The major came in another vehicle, talked to us for a while. Kathy Kelly talked a lot about nonviolence. And finally he said, I'm going to have to arrest you. And Kathy and Grace and Audrey all sat on the ground and locked their arms. And the Israeli major said, oh, don't ruin my day. And they arrested Jeff and I. And they took us to a police station at the checkpoint. We saw our Palestinians, by the way, nearby, blindfolded, hands bound behind their back, being led away. We were not treated that way, though. We were interrogated by Israeli officers. We had a quite long philosophical discussion about the occupation with these people. And finally, they said, we could deport you, we could arrest you, but we're just going to take you out of the territories to the Megiddo Junction and drop you there and stamp your records. If you go back in the territories, you'll be instantly deported. And we said, well, what about our women friends? And they said, well, they'll be brought along soon. Let us drive you to the Megiddo and leave you there. We said, well, we're not leaving without the women. And they said, well, call them on your cell phones and see what's happening. So we called them from the prison. We could see the road through this barbed wire, and that's the road to Jenin. And Kathy Kelly answers the phone, and I said, what happened? She said, well, the weirdest thing. She said, the major said after an hour that under Israeli law, the only people that can arrest a woman are a woman police officer. And they weren't able to find one. So he finally said, look, I've got other fish to fry. And he said, here. And he gave them sunblock, water, and a loaf of bread and said, be careful, and drove off. And I said, so what are you doing? She says, we're walking to Jenin. And so in the role of the collaborator in Ratfink, I told the police what had happened and saying, well, we want to join them. And he said, well, of course not. And he said, I'm going to send another police officer to go get them. And he said he wanted to take us back to Megiddo. And we refused, and finally he said, look, I'll take you a quarter mile from the checkpoint back to an intersection, and you can wait there until your friends come. So they did that. They drove Jeff and I to this intersection where there was a sign left from the day before his demonstration, and we propped it up on that, again, the little guardrail. And we talked to Kathy, and Kathy said several vehicles had gone by, and I said, did they arrest you? They said, no, they waved at us. And we said, well, we don't want to just stand here and be separated from this. So Jeff and I talked, and we decided we're going to try to rejoin you. And she says, how? And he says, we'll figure it out. So what we did is we went down a side road perpendicular to the border and to the right of the checkpoint. There was a big electric fence there, and we followed that maybe 300 yards and went up a side road into another town and through the narrow streets there. And then we went into this olive grove and then through some cactus and down into some woods, and we came to another very steep hill, a small mountain, and finally we found a trail. At this point, we're about 2 miles to the east of the checkpoint. We could see it way in the distance. When we got to this trail, Jeff wanted me to take this picture because he said it would be later for us to judge if this was stupid or brave. thing to do. And then we went over this hill and over another hill where we finally met some Palestinians. A civil engineer drew us a map and led us to this road, which reconnected to the road that Kathy and Grace were on. And once we got to that road, we continued walking to Jenin. We were stopped six more times by two different tanks twice, armored vehicles, and a jeep. Sometimes it was just curiosity, and we would get away with a sort of a half answer. Other times they would persist and threaten to arrest us or shoot us, and we would say, we're going anyway, we have to continue. One time they really screamed and yelled at us, get in the vehicle, we're taking you, and we refused, and finally they drove off. So we, using this method, we eventually reached the outskirts of Jenin, where there was a huge military base, and there were lots of soldiers coming in, lots of tanks. And we had talked to a colonel, a major, several lieutenants. And at this point, a general came out. And the general spoke to us with a lot of other officers. And we had the same conversation, very familiar to us by this point. It's not allowed, closed area. And he gave us all the reasons, and very polite to us. And we finally said, look, you know, sir, we know you can't give us authority to go through here. But what would you do if, without your permission, taking full responsibility, we walked right through this checkpoint? And he goes, well, I would have my men very gently bring you back. And here's the rub. You know, a Palestinian that looks out the window in a curfew can be shot. An international activist, think about this, an American, I would bring you very gently. I mean, we have power in these situations. And so we said, well, we're going to talk about what we're going to do. And he said, well, do that. I'll leave these officers to stay here. And he left us. And we ended up in a long discussion with this major and colonel and several other lower officers and some privates. One of the Israelis had on his jacket, make love, not war. Another one had Born to Run written on it. And it reminded me of like Vietnam graffiti of some of these guys. And the conversations ran the gamut with people that supported the occupation, that talked about all Arabs should be killed, to people who said, I sympathize with you, and, you know, what can we do, and so on. A lot of different opinions. And at one point, the major started saying, well, look at these little girls, because Grace and Audrey are rather short. These little girls can't go out here. And to Kathy Kelly's also rather short, and said, you know, that's not right. And Kathy Kelly said, I was in Bosnia four times. And the soldiers were sort of amazed at this. And he said, boy, you people have a lot of faith. And I said, that's nothing. I said, the people of Israel fled from the army of Pharaoh to the Red Sea, and they didn't even bring a boat. I said, but God got them through somehow. And then he paused for a minute, and he says, look, go back 100 meters and cut through the fields. We said, great, done. We picked up our bags, and then some of the privates drew their guns, and the colonel said, no, go back and go through the fields. So we went back 100 meters, and we cut through an onion field and later a wheat field, which we thought would be really romantic, but actually it's like walking through deep snow. It's really hard. But and as we started doing this, there were three armored personnel vehicles to the right with their machine guns trained on us, and we were hoping we were not being lied to in this instance because it would have been really bad. But as it turned out, it was sincere, and we walked to Jenin, which is in the distance. Now, we reached Jenin City, which is next to the camp that night. There was a severe curfew on it, but as soon as we arrived the streets, there were bullet shells everywhere. Not only regular bullets, 22 and a higher caliber, but they were these big shells. I don't even know what shoots them. But the Palestinians say they'll go through a parked car and through the concrete wall of a house, and there were lots of these on the road. And a Palestinian woman, in spite of the curfew, took us through the streets and brought us to an elementary school, a five-story elementary school, rather big building run by the Jenin Charitable Society, which was now a refugee center for 800 Palestinian women and children. And we went into this building, and they found a place for us to stay that night. And when we got there, this doctor was talking to us, and after dark, Shivas Moore appears. She had come to Jenin over the mountains by herself. And when she had arrived, after dark, she went to the refugee camp, which was very tightly sealed and lots of shooting by Israeli soldiers. There was no more shooting by Palestinians at that point, although there had been some previous. The Palestinians had defended the camp, and 23 Israelis were killed, by the way, in those early battles, but that was done by this point. Anyway, Shevis Moore had gone to the camp, demanded, she said she needed to go in. She says, I'm a medical relief worker. They said, you can't. It's closed. We'll shoot you. She says, look, there are people in need there. I have to go see what the need is. And she walked right through the soldiers, and they didn't touch her. And she was there an hour and came back and walked to us. She said she had counted 14 bodies in that 1 hour. Three of them very, very badly burned, beyond recognition. Some of them, by their size, obviously children. And so she was talking to this Dr. Jamal, trying to make a plan for the next day to bring relief supplies into the camp. While we were waiting in this elementary school classroom for a place to sleep, a woman came and asked Kathy Kelly if she would hold her baby. And this baby was born on April 2nd, the night of the Israeli attack in Jenin. And the mother and father had picked the name of the baby, but the father was shot and arrested by the Israelis about 5 minutes after the baby was born. And the mother changed the name of the baby to the name of the last suicide bomber. And this is an example to me of how violence breeds violence, that this person that had changed picked a neutral name now would dedicate this beautiful, innocent young life to a suicide bomber as an act of anger toward what was happening to her husband. The next morning, excuse me one sec, we decided we had to see the refugee camp. To this point, everybody told us no one was getting in the camp. As far as we knew, Chevis Moore was the first person ever to do it. We asked Chevis if we could go with her the next day, and she said she'd rather not jeopardize her efforts, you know, by having others with her. So she went on her own. Well, we went through the street carrying our own white flag through Jenin City, and there were hundreds of tanks and your personnel carriers racing in different directions and lots of gunfire here and there. But we skirted these tanks and walked through the streets of the city. The city is largely intact, Jenin City. This is the mosque. But as you approach the refugee camp, the destruction begins to mount. And, you know, the same old thing. And when you got right to the outskirts, there weren't even any more roads. The roads were all dug up. There were tanks. And about 8 Israeli soldiers stopped us and told us the same things they've always told us. And at this point, we developed a different plan. What we would do is we would see who was the officer, and 2 or 3 of us would talk to the officer about all kinds of things, philosophy, nonviolence, politics. And while we were having that conversation, the others in our group, the other 3, would inch their way forward around the edges. And eventually the soldier would realize they were about 10 yards behind him, and he would rush back to stop those others, and then we would advance. And then different people would talk. And this sort of song and dance would go on block after block, deeper and deeper into the refugee camp. And it became clearer that they would yell, they would cajole, they would argue, they would do all kinds of things, but they wouldn't even physically touch us. And so we were pushing the envelope. And all the while, more and more tanks, more and more soldiers around us. And this is actually one of the most shocking things I saw there. All outside the camp, there are these big bulldozers. And these were used to knock down houses because the refugee camp was very tight. So they needed to knock down houses so they could get the tanks into the narrow streets. And many Palestinians were killed and buried alive in their homes by these bulldozers. But also, the relief agencies were appealing after the attacks had finished on the 8th or 9th of April, were appealing for these bulldozers to be used for search and rescue. And in fact, Israel had loaned bulldozers like this to Turkey after an earthquake for that just that purpose. But they were left on the sides unmoved. And even after the camp was finally opened and relief agencies were allowed in, the Israelis wouldn't let them use these bulldozers. All the rescue and the search for bodies in Jenin, even to this day, have been done by pickaxe and by hand. When we got a little ways into the camp, we saw an ambulance ahead of us. And we got closer to it. I was wondering, who is this? Because no relief agency was in the camp. We realized it was Chevis Moore. And what she had done is she had gone in the camp that morning. She had found a fire truck, and she hotwired it and drove it in the camp and gave water to people until the truck stalled. And then she went out to the relief office, and she got a commandeered an ambulance and drove it again in. And she went to a blown-up pharmacy, and she was filling this plastic bucket with medicines and warm soft drinks to give to families. I mean, this woman was fearless. Incredible. This morning, in 2 hours, she counted 24 bodies. But unlike the previous night, Israeli soldiers followed her everywhere she went. And every time a body was found, the soldiers took it away. And no one knew where it went. It's a big bone of contention in Jenin how many people were killed, by the way. But the attacks by the Palestinian militants ceased on the 8th or 9th. And Jenin was not opened until the 17th. So for all of those days, no one knows what was happening, whether bodies were being removed, destroyed, or what. No one really knows. And there are still hundreds of people unaccounted for, even to this day, so no one really knows. This is the view in the center of the camp, looking out towards the fields that we crossed. This is the view in the opposite direction. There are 350 homes in the center of the camp that are completely gone, obliterated. There are over 500 more that are extremely badly damaged by tanks, by jets, and by helicopters, and also by ground troops. It's incredible destruction in that camp. There's a big argument about whether or not there was a massacre there. Palestinian apologists claim there was a massacre there, could be Srebrenica, so on, and that word became touted around. Human Rights Watch did a preliminary investigation in which they said they could see none of the confirm none of the signs of a massacre, although they felt there was a need for more investigation and to wait until, you know, all the search and rescue had taken place. The Israelis initially gave agreement to an investigation by the UN and then withdrew that, and no investigation took place. Now many apologists for Israel will point to the Human Rights Watch, say the Palestinians lie that there was a massacre there. But if you read the Human Rights Watch report, it doesn't say that there was not one. It says they couldn't confirm one. But they could confirm, even in the preliminary reports, that there were massive war crimes perpetrated there. That report is very, very damning of Israel, and it should be read in its entirety. The day after we went, we don't know if that was coincidental or not, the camp was open to relief workers and to internationals. In many instances, they only found body parts, like this bone found by this rescue worker. Now, in the context of all of this suffering and all of these attacks and more that I can't even begin to describe to you tonight, there's so many things. Some Palestinians would make this claim that Zionism is Nazism, and make a graffiti like this one, which was in Gaza in 1988. And if any of you went to the demonstration in Washington, D.C. Last month, you may have seen there were banners held by some Palestinians that showed Adolf Hitler giving Ariel Sharon a hug, saying, "Nice work, well done." This kind of rhetoric, I would just suggest that people stay as far away from as possible. It's inflammatory and it's not historically accurate. I can tell you hundreds of stories of atrocities by the Israelis, but I would not say that it's a case of genocide. They're not taking people to camps and putting them in ovens. It's not Nazism. There are some parallels, but it's not a helpful comparison. It closes down dialogue. And when you make this kind of graffiti, it associates all of Judaism, which is even more outrageous than just saying Zionism is Nazism. And it's really inflammatory. And I really encourage people not to use that imagery. And if you have to use national symbols like the Palestinian flag, I encourage you to use the Israeli flag at the same time. Because if you use just the Palestinian flag, some people will interpret that as you want to destroy the state of Israel. And you want to say the region should be controlled by only one nationalist group, and it'd be the Palestinian group. Now, I stay away from the symbols altogether, but if you have to use them, I suggest you use them together. And in spite of those caveats, I think we can say this, that U.S. military aid is an outrage, and it's a violation of so many international laws and U.S. laws, what Israel is doing with our aid, that we should all be favorable of this position. And a member of the Israeli Knesset told me in 1988, when I asked what would bring peace, he said if the U.S. Congress would hold hearings on cutting military aid, there'd be peace tomorrow at 12 noon. And I think that's largely still believed to be true. We are definitely under, you know, when President Bush told Ariel Sharon to withdraw, stop, pull out, now, without delay, and Ariel Sharon ignored him, none of that really had any teeth. But if President Bush had said, look, I order a freeze on U.S. military aid, I think we would have seen an entirely different response. And remember, when you're dealing with this issue, there are Israeli Jews who want peace and are even willing to accept, you know, to resolve some of the controversial issues like Jerusalem, you know, to share Jerusalem, like these Israeli activists, capital of two states. And like this man, Guy Grossman, who's one of the military reservists in Israel, now there are over 500 Israelis, officers, and others, some very high ranking, who are refusing to serve in the occupied territories. They're not pacifists. They will fight for Israel, but to defend Israel in the pre-67 borders and not elsewhere. And this group is another group that gives credibility to opposition to the occupation. And there are still internationals going through the international solidarity movement. And I have, again, websites there, and they're still appealing for people to go, and you don't need special expertise, and anyone in this room can go do it. And your observations will be, you know, will add to the body of knowledge here, which is desperately needed of what the occupation is really about. And remember, there are people like Irene Siegel here holding a sign that's hard to read. It says, American Jews say end the occupation, end USA to Israel. You can subscribe to Tikkun magazine and read the writings of Rabbi Michael Lerner with a wonderful perspective, American Jew, on the occupation. There, you know, you're not being anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish to criticize the occupation.